Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Panthers coach Dave Canales talking about the Patriots, Mike Vrabel, everything going on here in New England as we get ready for Sunday's matchup between the Panthers, the Patriots. As Tom Curran said, Patriots stink at home, Panthers stink on the road, so something's got to give. Good for our guy Mark Schlereth and the Fox broadcast crew. They got a heck of a game here. Although, I'll say it, you could have another really entertaining football game between two bad teams. That is a possibility on the horizon. We have a little news update that I don't know if we care about. And I'll tell you what it is before I wonder why we should care about it. Boss Man Laird put in our little group text chat a tweet from Jordan Schultz, the Schultz Report. Sources, Patriots star cornerback Christian Gonzalez has made, quote, good progress, unquote, in his hamstring recovery and is likely to make his season debut Sunday versus the Panthers. Well, first of all, I think we knew that because he was at his locker and basically said he wanted to play last week and all that. But yes, Dan Ball.
Which rat did Jordan Schultz go to this time for that information?
Hopefully it's a better rat because the last rat told him he'd be ready for season opener week one. And that rat was really wrong.
Is it fair to say you're playing this Sunday?
I'm excited.
Yeah, he's excited. He's going to play. And you were wrong a month ago, Jordan Schultz, when you told me he wasn't going to miss any regular season games. So I'm not going to listen to your reports. But this is a winnable football game, like they all kind of have been to start the season. They've only won one of them. The Panthers got a weird win last week in which they didn't really play that well, but thanks to Michael Penix, were able to win the football game. Interception
shut him
return.
Out.
Yes, shut him out. 30-0. There's a lot going on here. Tet McMillan, who is their scariest offensive player, if you saw the visuals of what he physically is capable of doing, he is banged up. I'm not sure what his status will be come game time on Sunday, and that would be obviously an interesting matchup if Gonzalez is back out there, Tet McMillan versus Gonzalez. If he's not, you have a questionable quarterback with questionable receivers for a team that can't run the football. That sounds like a get-right recipe for the Patriots' defense, Ted Johnson.
Yeah. And let me tell you something. You know, you look at Bryce Young, compare him to Drake May, and you go, let's see, Bryce Young, how many he got 3 interceptions and 1 fumble. So he's got more turnovers than Drake May does. So there's an opportunity there.
Oh, great. So we're going to have a turnover battle.
There's a opportunity there to get after, you know, Bryce Young and turn that ball over. The Patriots defenders should be and coaches should be talking about Bryce Young like the Steelers defense was talking about Ramondre Stevenson and Drake May last week.
Did
you hear all the reports that all these guys, all they did was talk about how much that the two running backs and the quarterback fumble and throw the ball away? So please, you got to win this game. I mean, come on, Bryce Young. He had his moments in college, but he's just never really he flashed at the end of last year, I guess, to some degree, but it's gotten off to a slow start. They do have a running back that's outperforming any of your running backs in Chuba Hubbard, but he's what, 168 total yards in 3 games. So, I don't know. To me, let's go. It really shouldn't be close, but because I'm just not a believer in Bryce Young.
Yeah, but I'm not sure the Patriots fitsy are in this really shouldn't be close range.
Let me ask you this. What's the quarterback, Drake May versus Bryce Young? Who do you got?
Oh, Drake May.
And it's not even close, right?
Not even close. So, I mean, they benched Bryce Young last September.
So that should tell you something about this game.
And then I thought he bounced back and then I went and started to look at some of his stats and I was like, he didn't really bounce back. He just kind of kept playing and got his job back. There wasn't this
stinking out loud.
Yeah, he just sucked less. He sucked a little instead of sucking a lot, as Lou Maloney would say. Yes, Dan Ball.
What about the rest of the offense, though? Do you take Chuba Hubbard over the current Patriots running back room, and then do you take the Panthers wide receiver room over what the Patriots have to round out that offensive conversation?
If Tet McMillan plays, then I'll take them.
Okay.
If Tet McMillan doesn't play, then I'll take the Patriots. Yeah. Tet McMillan is looking like he's going to be the closest thing to a number one wide receiver on these two teams' depth charts. But if he's not out there, then they are Hunter Renfrow and Xavier Leggett.
Leggett is also banged up. Hunter Renfrow is,
permanently banged up.
Yeah, Chuba Hubbard's a great up. He's got speed, but he's not. I mean, if you're just going to key in on Chuba Hubbard the whole day, then to challenge their wide receivers to beat you with an undersized quarterback, advantage Patriots across the board.
All right, so let me ask, if Tet McMillan doesn't play, do you think the game should even be close?
No, and I don't think we should be talking about the defense having any ups and downs. If Tet McMillan doesn't play, this should be the game where you go, yeah, we expected that type of defense. We expected you to be better, accountable, consistent, all of that.
Yeah.
That's what the – because you're getting Christian Gonzalez back. Even if it's only 20 plays, you're talking about at least a third of the game.
And Tech McMillan, by far, he has six plays of 20 or more yards already.
Yeah, if he plays,
three games.
I'm a little worried.
And the Patriots defense cannot stop the big play.
The X play. Dan Ball loves when I use the Mike Vrabel X play term. Yeah, if he plays – then I don't know, because they have been susceptible to those big plays.
And just a side note about the Patriots defense, it is kind of interesting. You remember they were very aggressive in their blitzing and play calling in week one versus Las Vegas?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. In the first half, they had success against Geno Smith.
Yep.
Well, then the Raiders went in at halftime, and they made adjustments. And they came out in the second half, and Chip Kelly had a game plan to just slice through all those blitzes. They were just – Geno was killing the Patriots blitzing. And you haven't seen any exotic blitzing since that game. The last two games, very conservative game plan. So you're trying to kind of figure out, what is this identity of this defense? What do they really want to be? Maybe with Christian Gonzalez back, it'll become clear, because I feel like with him out, it was probably dictating how they called games. So we'll see.
Fitzy.
Yeah, but the one thing that we're sort of overlooking in that regards, fellas, is Terrell Williams was actually there calling the defense week one, and it's been Zach Kerr. And you just can't help but wonder, I imagine you could probably speak most of this, Ted. Like, do you think they'd be calling safer defenses without somebody that has the knowledge and the breadth of experience that Terrell Williams does, as opposed to someone who's a bit greener in Zach Kerr?
I think it's a fair point. I mean, Terrell Williams was there all in training camp, and they were aggressive all training camp.
Oh, yeah.
They were blitzing all the time. And so now that Terrell Williams hasn't been there the last 2 weeks, and you see a conservative game plan called, you start to wonder, man, which is weird to me, because if there's the DNA of this defense wants to be a blitzing, aggressive defense, you would think it didn't matter who the signal caller was, he would call an aggressive defense.
Right. So, especially since the signal caller, the first one, Terrell Williams, is a longtime Vrabel assistant. So you'd think they would kind of be on the same page, and Vrabel would lead Zach Kerr sort of down the same road that Terrell Williams would normally. And Terrell Williams is still helping out in a consistent consultant-type role during the week, so he still has a voice there. But it is interesting. I do think they're about to kind of just go with Zach Kerr moving forward. He's going to be the play caller. There was a comment from Vrabel this week that made it sound like that was very much on the table, which will allow us to figure out some week-to-week kind of patterns, consistency, what they want to be. I would also put in there, although you'd think you'd actually blitz a little bit less without your best cornerback on the field. You'd think that would open you up to blitz a little more when you get Christian Gonzalez back.
You would think.
So we'll see how that all goes. One thing that jumped out to me was how much emphasis they are putting on special teams, because I don't know if you guys heard it. Mike Vrabel said he spent over 2 hours watching their kickoff team. Their kickoff team has a dirty kick, which is apparently some form of a knuckleball that lands in the landing zone in the field of play, but it can move really strangely. And it sounds like kickoffs for the Panthers are a bit of something to keep an eye on, a weapon that they potentially think could have a big factor in this game.
Okay.
A point of emphasis. Okay. All
okay.
Right.
Something to watch.
Fun.
Yeah.
Put that on a board.
I don't know about knuckleballs on kickoffs, and I haven't seen it in person yet, or with thine own eyes. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine that would be difficult.
Yeah, I'm guessing they're practicing catching knuckleballs in practice all week. If that's the case, if there's a lot of film on that. I haven't seen the play you're talking about, so I can't.
Yeah, we'll see. Reminder, though, we won't talk to Jeremy Springer this week because tomorrow on WEEI Afternoons, when we are at Fenway Park, we'll be talking to Josh McDaniels.
Oof.
So we can get some of the
tough questions. To ask.
Yeah, we do. We do. It's funny. You won't be there to ask those questions. Don't worry. We'll ask them for you. What he's doing with the running backs, how that's going to be handled. Does he have a say in that, or is that just strictly Vrabel down? Here's your guys.
What were you thinking on that 4th-and-1 play there, Josh?
I may have a different tone.
Can you walk us through that 4th-and-1 play?
That I don't mind. Josh, can you walk us through what was supposed to happen on that 4th-and-1 play?
Would you like
but there's tone on that.
We're going to workshop these.
Anything you say, you can't help it, has tone.
No, that's not true. Rich Keefe is way worse. I may have tone. Rich Keefe has tone on steroids when he asks questions. Anyway, let's get back to the Drake May stuff. I am fascinated with the evolution of Ted Johnson's views on Drake May. You were really high on him coming into the year, the offseason. Then you kind of wavered. Then you really liked what you saw in Miami. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like you're back on his bandwagon, so to speak, but not maybe as much back on the bandwagon as the rest of the world is.
It feels familiar, doesn't it? Because this is pretty much you on every take.
Oh, wow. Shots fired.
So I can understand how you say that. I'm very high on him. I'm just pointing out concerns. That doesn't mean I've lost belief or trust in him or don't think he can still be a great player, but I'm pointing out things that are factual and real concerns, but that doesn't mean I have lost any belief in him.
So is this a consistent trend in the right direction? Are you feeling at least that, even if it has a couple little ups and downs? Yep. Is this like real estate?
Yep.
You know, you ever check those real estate charts on like your home value? Yep. Yeah, there's dips along the way, but in general it goes up.
He is trending. I don't think he's trending as fast as people think. Can I give you a couple examples?
Go ahead.
Why? Okay, so first off, the Pats' first three defenses they played all rank in the bottom half of defensive DVOA.
Yep.
So, so just to be clear, so you know Drake May, he's and I'll read you some of the things that he's top 10 in. All right, so he's top 10 in a lot of different categories, but you have to consider the competition he's playing, and so that stat I just gave kind of highlights that. Also, you have to understand that the NFL offenses are only averaging 317 yards per game. That is the lowest total since 2005, and the third lowest total this century. So what does that mean? That means overall just offenses are down. So if you're ranked high, it's not saying as much as it would if – the offenses were performing like you thought they would perform in, right?
Yeah.
So there's perspective to all of this when it comes to Drake May top 10, the competition he's played, and then the competition across the board that give him those rankings are all down compared to years past.
Yeah, I think, Fitzy, the flip side of that would be, if you wanted to put everything in perspective, is first year with a new offensive coordinator, first year with a new coach, all new coaches, questionable production from the wide receiver position. Talk about questions I want to ask Josh McDaniel. How do you get more from the receiver position? You look across the league, Fitzy, wide receivers are supposed to make a lot of plays. They're supposed to be sort of the heartbeat of the passing game, and that just isn't really true here. So I think those are some reasons that put some of the limitations of the offense in perspective.
Yes, the fact that Drake May has chemistry with Hunter Henry, that's long since established. I would say that is his most dependable target and has a lot of passing yards to the running back room at large. And then there is a precipitous drop off. I won't call it concerning, but it's certainly something that bears watching. Like, who is the next guy? Is it Kayshon Booty? They seem to have something going on, but it's not consistent enough. Nothing with Pop Douglas, obviously. Efton Chisholm hasn't played yet. I don't know what the hell to make of the relationship between Drake May and Stephon Diggs off the field or especially on the field. It's just, it's there, but it's not clicking. And then Kyle Williams is an afterthought, obviously a rookie, third rounder, but explosive. It would be nice to see him get involved in the game so they can start stretching the field. They stretch the field a little bit, maybe then they'll open things up for the running attack.
So, wait a minute. You don't think he's got a connection with Diggs or Douglas?
No, not so much. I mean, it's 12, 13 catches. They're averaging like 8-9 yards. Like, you would expect Stephon Diggs and Drake May to click to a point where that's the first guy he looks to in trouble, in a pinch, when he needs him. And it's they're okay together, but I just don't think they're as dynamic together as I thought they would be yet.
I guess it's just disappointing there's just not more down the field passes to Steph Diggs, because he's in the 15 targets to Diggs, he's caught 13 of them, so he's very efficient throwing to Diggs.
But
it's just not down the field. It's in the slot, which he's pretty much what he played mostly in Houston last year. He's become really more of a slot receiver. To me, it's DeMario Douglas. I mean, 13 targets and only 5 catches. That's the one where you say they need to be more on the same page.
Yeah, I've given up on that. They don't need to be on the same page. They don't need to be on the same field.
New Yoshida.
Yeah, he's my new Yoshida. Absolutely. And the one thing I would say about Diggs, though, and small sample of 3 games, I guess, is I think the numbers are kind of inverted for a guy in his first year with a new team coming off an ACL. His numbers have gone downward over 3 weeks, even though Drake May keeps saying, I got to get him the ball more. I want to get him the ball more. I think he only had 3 targets for 3 catches last week, including being the nearest guy standing with the game on the line on 4th-and-1 next to Pop Douglas while Pop Douglas is coming up short of the sticks. And I keep going back to what Brian Hoyer told us on Tuesday. Players over plays. Players over plays. So if we take that from a quarterback in the Josh McDaniels system, if you're Drake May, which players are you favoring over plays?
Tight ends.
Yeah.
Easily.
So it's Hunter Henry, who he did. He had a big day, right? Yep. I mean, but you have to have other guys. Who's next in line?
Hunter Henry leads the team in the receptions.
You can say it was Ramondre 2 weeks ago. But now Ramondre's fumbling. He's kind of benched. He's not part of the offense. Is it Steph Diggs that takes that next role? Is it his guy Booty, who had the big first game? Remember? Fitzy's guy, ML Football, was aggregating that Booty was on pace for 1,700 Fitzy's yards guy. Receiving or whatever that was. And he hasn't really been able to keep up that consistent pace. So players over plays, I don't know if Drake May has a lot of players. He's like, I know exactly what that guy's going to do for me with the game on the line. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So
very fair.
That's part of the balance of what is Drake May achieving right now. Like, he's improving. He's making mistakes on his own, but so's the same true for his targets.
It is interesting because you look at, did you see how many receivers he threw to? He threw to 9 different receivers, but it's like one catch. And so as much as it's impressive that he quote-unquote spreads the ball around, he doesn't have a consistent go-to guy in critical situations, which is more important than quote-unquote spreading the ball around.
Every good quarterback has that. I'll say that I'm sure there's counter examples, a few, but for the most part, Tom Brady, greatest quarterback of all time, went to either Edelman or Gronk in that phase, or went to Welker or Moss in that phase. Like, he had guy, or went to Branch and Givens. Like,
yeah,
you had a couple
Troy
guys.
Brown or,
right.
You know, and
there were always guys that were the guys that he knew he could go to with the game on the line, and he just doesn't. Or Josh Allen with Diggs is the perfect example. I know it went south when it started to be like, oh, he wants the ball too much, but Josh Allen and the Bills blew up when he targeted Stephon Diggs, whatever, 10 or 11 times a game. That was their success. Speaking of success, this isn't great news, but we need to go to the clinch desk for an update.
What do we got?
It's not good. You're not going to like what you have to hear.
All my friends in Houston, I'd see them tweeting. They're very excited right
now. Yeah, they're having a good
John McClain.
They're having a good day right now. 5-0 Astros, top half of the 3rd inning. Not going great for JT Ginn so far. 2 1/3, 4 hits, 5 runs, all earned, 2 walks, 3 strikeouts. It was 2 runs in the top half of the first, 3 more in the top of the second.
So such a great story.
Astros are at bat, John McClain. Astros at bat, top half of the 3rd, up by 5. So again, it's an Astros loss or a Red Sox win.
That's right.
So we're just seeing if the Red Sox can have this wrapped up by the time first pitch happens tonight.
Right. We were hoping it might happen during our show. It's looking less likely.
We just win tonight. We're good.
Just win tonight, Bayo.
Or do it on Friday, Fenway Friday.
No. I mean, that's fine if it has to wait till Friday, but I'd rather just get it out of the way, be done with it. Yes, we'll be at Fenway tomorrow. That would be fun,
Somebody
too.
Might be staying after the game and want to see it.
Hey-o. Oh, Dan Ball, okay, sticking around to watch a little clinching baseball. Interesting. Up next, next here on WEEI Afternoons, friend of the program, friend of Ted Johnson, Gary Myers, the author of Belichick vs. Brady. That is out now. You can get it on Amazon. He'll join us to talk about all things Belichick, Brady, and the Patriots, which are basically stories that never die and never go away. Gary Myers up next here on WEEI Afternoons. But first, Dan Ball has what's trending, even if it's that bad stuff from Houston.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Back here on WEEI Afternoons, we'll go right to the guest line where we are joined by Gary Myers, author of Brady vs. Belichick, The Dynasty Debate, available now on Amazon, Goodreads, or wherever books are sold. Mr. Myers, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. How are you guys doing today?
We're great. Good, Gary.
You're here with Andy Hart, Nick Fitzy-Stevens, and Ted Johnson. And my first question right out the gates is one of the most interesting things I think in your book is Mo Lewis talking about the famous, infamous hit on Drew Bledsoe that jump-started the career of one Tom Brady. And I don't know if victim shaming is the right word, but he kind of puts it on Drew Bledsoe, basically, for the reason he got hit so badly and kind of jump-started everything. Were you surprised to hear that?
Not really, because I knew that Mo had been very bitter over the years because he feels Jet fans are blaming him for Tom Brady and the Patriots dynasty, which is kind of ridiculous when you think about it, guys. I mean, Drew should have run out of bounds or he should have gone down. All Mo was doing was his job, which is trying to prevent Bledsoe from picking up a first down. It was a 10-3 game. I think like 5 minutes left or something like that. And the Jets were up, and it was a 3rd and 10, and Drew couldn't find a receiver, so he takes off. And Mo was running from, waiting for him to kind of make a right turn and run out of bounds. Instead, he made a left turn and tried to turn it up. And even in the way the league is today, and, you know, Ted, you know this as well as anybody, that if you breathe on a quarterback, they'll throw a flag. Mm-hmm. They should really be wearing red jerseys out there to leave no doubt. But even today, that would not be deemed a dirty hit. I mean, it was vicious, and Jet players on the opposite sideline heard it. And I know, Ted, you said it was the loudest. I think I quoted you in the book saying it was the loudest hit you've ever heard. But there was nothing illegal about it. And clearly, you know, Jet fans were happy when he made the tackle at the time. If you had told them that 20 years later, Brady would leave New England with 6 Super Bowl championships and the Jets would still only have Super Bowl III, I don't think anybody would have believed that at that point in time.
Gary, it was, guys, it was the loud. I've never heard anything like it. It was a vicious, vicious hit, and just the sound would tell you as much. But, Gary, let's get right to it, man. All right. I got crushed for my opinions on this. I'm curious what you think. We were part of that Vice special that was that three show kind of Brady versus Belichick. Who was more responsible? And so, you know, through all your research and talking to people, who was in that relationship between Brady and Belichick? Who was the driver and who was the passenger in that relationship? Or are they both equally, getting credit for what happened here?
No, I mean, my opinion is it can't be equal. And, you know, based on the people that I spoke to, and it was a lot of people, it's Brady. But that's not to minimize, obviously, Belichick's responsibility, especially early on when, you know, he drafted him, even though it was Dick Rabine's suggestion. You know, Belichick still had to make the pick, and then he kept him as a 4-string quarterback. He kept him when Drew was healthy.
2 months later. So you can't really slight Belichick for his influence on the dynasty. I think what's really happened is there's some recency bias involved here where, you know, Tom goes on to win a Super Bowl in Tampa in his first year and Belichick gets fired after four seasons without Brady in New England, and people go, wow, that just proves it. It was all Brady all the time. We knew it. I just think what they did separately is irrelevant to the argument that my book is really based on their contributions when they were together. I think that's the thing we have to make judgment on, not what they did separately. And so I came up with, you know, my own formula, my own way of doing it. And, you know, I don't want to give away the number on the show, but, you know, it's Brady, but not by a landslide. Maybe in a presidential election, the numbers I came up with would be a landslide, but not in this, especially when those who were taking the, you know, post New England years for Brady into consideration and the post Brady years in New England into consideration. I think if you factor that in, you know, most people would say it was 90% Brady just because they're looking at what they did separately. But I have it much, much closer than that.
Gary, you get a chance to speak to so many different people in New York as well as with the Patriots nationally as well. That's one of the fun aspects of the book that I enjoyed personally. And what would you say through all those different conversations with executives, former players, coaches, what would you say that you learned about Belichick and or Brady that surprised you or caught you off guard the most?
I mean, there were some things that I was surprised about, but, you know, even though I worked at the Daily News in New York all those years, I felt like the Patriots were almost our third team because the rivalry with the Jets, you know, going back to the Parcells days, and then certainly with Belichick going up there, I covered a lot of their games and then the two Super Bowls against the Giants. So I felt I went into this whole project with a lot of institutional knowledge, you know, having been around the Patriots. It covered so many of their playoff games that and I had done the Brady Manning book, so I got to know Tom really well during that period of time. I think the thing that really surprised me is that, and there were two distinct dynasties, the first 10 years, the second 10 years, and there weren't many, you know, crossovers from one to the other, but it seemed to me that Tom never changed the way he was in the locker room. And I think that really ingratiated himself with his teammates, that despite all his accomplishments, he was still the same guy. Now, I think he's changed now, you know, since he stopped playing. Yeah. But I really believe that he tried to remain the same guy throughout. And, you know, Devin McCourty told me a story. You know, when he was drafted, he bumped into Tom at a minicamp his rookie year. And Tom came over and introduced himself to him. And Tom goes, you know, I think I know who you are, you know. And Tom, you know, was saying, oh, you know, you're a first-round pick. I'm really glad you're around. I think you can really help me. And Devin went home, or maybe just to the rookie hotel that night, and called his mom, all excited. Mom, Tom Brady knew who I was. You know, and I think just Tom had that, you know, kind of humble persona around his teammates that you didn't know that he had, you know, towards the end had won six Super Bowls. I was kind of impressed by that. And then Belichick never really changed the way he treated Tom or any other players. And Ted, you know, as well as anybody, that the way he treated players, it wasn't exactly with a lot of respect and courtesy and caring and compassion. And, you know, he never really changed that. I really felt that when I learned a lot about Belichick is that I think once a guy left the Patriots and retired and came back, he greeted him with open arms. But he was just so wary of becoming close to any of his players because he knew one day the ending would not be pretty. And so he didn't want it to be an emotional decision. And so he divorced himself emotionally from his players when he had them. And now he tries to be a great guy when they come back. And I don't know that always works. It's kind of hard to forget how you got treated.
Gary Myers, author of Brady vs. Belichick, The Dynasty Debate. Mr. Myers, what do you think of what Bill Belichick's been doing over the last, 10 months or so, both in terms of his personal life and his professional life at UNC?
Well, I was really surprised that after he got fired by the Patriots, and let's not make any mistake about it, you know, despite how they tried to frame it at the time, based on what they've said since, and I thought at the time, Bill definitely got fired by Kraft, and the animosity that's come out since then is, to me, it's kind of embarrassing for everybody. But I was really surprised Bill didn't get a job in the NFL. I thought at the time, and I wrote at the time, I thought he was a perfect fit for Jerry Jones in Dallas because they were both kind of at the same point in their lives where all they were interested in doing was trying to win. And Jerry didn't go for it. I have a passage in my book where Dean Spanos of the Chargers called up Jimmy Johnson to kind of quiz him about Belichick. This is like a month, not even a month after he got fired, because it was before Harbaugh was hired. And Jimmy's trying to convince Spanos to hire Belichick. And Spanos is going, but look how old he is. And Jimmy's saying, well, what's the difference? He's still got passion for the game. And if he can get you a Super Bowl in the next 3 years, you know, what do you care how long he stays for when most coaches get fired after 3-4 years anyway? And he couldn't convince them. And then he went and hired Harbaugh, which is, you know, working out well for him. But it just goes to show that, you know, Belichick made a lot of enemies while he was winning a lot. And when it came time to try to call in any favors, there was nobody really to call because he didn't treat people well on the way up. You know what they say, you get to see the same people on the way up as you see on the way down. And he got stuck having to go to North Carolina at the most volatile time in college sports history with the NILs and the transfer portal. I mean, we all know Bill's a smart guy. And he'll adjust, but whether he's going to be able to adjust quickly enough and convince his kids to come and play for him, I don't know. He's got to get a quarterback, and maybe things will fall into place. As far as his personal life, I'm not passing judgment on another man's life, but I have two daughters who are older than Jordan Hudson. And I can only imagine what I would if any of them ever came home with a 73-year-old man, I mean, my daughters are in their early 30s, and if that ever happened, I'd throw them out of the house. And after I threw him out of my house,
there you go.
I don't get it. I just don't get it.
All right,
you know, but each his own, you know.
Gary, last question for us. You wrote a book on Bill Parcells, Once a Giant. A story of victory, tragedy, and life after football. And Bill Parcells just got inducted into the Patriots Pro Football Hall of Fame this past weekend. A lot of people think that there's similarities between the two. I played for both of them. I think they couldn't be more different.
Yeah, I agree.
Could you just kind of in a minute or so just kind of give impression of the two men, what the how they relate to each other?
Yeah, first of all, the book was not just about Parcells. There was a lot of Parcells in it, but it was about the 86 Giants and their life after football, the Super Bowl team. But, of course, I agree with you. You know, they played off each other really well, and they were a great tandem, you know, probably as good tandem as has ever been in the NFL. You know, there was a trio with the Giants in another era with Lombardi and Landry, and then they both worked for Jim Lee Howell, but Lombardi and Landry on the same staff was pretty good also. But, you know, Bill is just a personable guy, and I know, Teddy, which of the two you enjoyed playing for more. Parcells was fun. You know, he was a taskmaster, but he was fun, and I think he was compassionate and he cared about his players. I don't think Bill cared about his players enough, and Bill, you know, Parcells did not win anything without Belichick. So clearly he was very instrumental in his two Super Bowls with the Giants. And even the one he got to in New England is when Belichick was on staff for that 1 year. But if I had a choice, I'll put it like this, because obviously I don't have a choice of who I wanted to play for. If but I did have a choice at times of who I wanted to cover. And I would cover Parcells 101 times out of 100 if I had a choice of the two to cover.
That's Gary Myers, author of Brady vs. Belichick, The Dynasty Debate. It's out now, available on Amazon and anywhere you get books. Mr. Myers, appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks, Gary.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Take care.
Appreciate See you, Gary. It. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Coming up here on WEEI Afternoons, we're going to touch on something he said and he ended with there that I want to clarify. So I don't care as much who he'd like to cover, because whatever, reporters, no one cares about reporters. They tell us that all the time on the text line and the Twitch line. But what Gary Myers thinks about what Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick think of their players, that's up next here on WEEI
Afternoons. Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland you know, think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
But Gary Myers joined us, the Brady vs. Belichick, the Dynasty Debate book out now. He wouldn't tell us his percentage, but it sounds like it's a little closer than yours. And his is just a two-person split. It doesn't include the others like you've included.
Yeah, I'm all-inclusive. I'm like, there was other characters that in this movie that should get some credit, too.
Plus, you're one of the others. Well, yeah, so yeah. I could see how you'd have that as a category. Right?
Yeah.
All right, but you did, there was an interesting answer at the end of Gary Myers, who joined us moments ago. If you want to hear the whole interview, you can go back on the Audacy app, AUDACY, rewind feature, or download WEEI Afternoons podcast. But he was comparing Bill Belichick and Bill Parcells. And he said something very interesting and very critical here.
Parcells was fun. You know, he was a taskmaster, but he was fun. And I think he was compassionate and he cared about his players. I don't think Bill cared about his players enough. And Bill, you know, Parcells did not win anything without Belichick. So clearly he was very instrumental in his two Super Bowls with the Giants. And even the one he got to in New England is when Belichick was on staff for that one year.
In case you missed it in the middle there, I don't think Bill, and he's talking about Belichick, cared enough about his players. And I want to emphasize that is Gary Myers, author of Brady vs. Belichick. That was not Ted Johnson. That was not Andy Hart. That was not Nick Fitzy Stevens. He said he does not think Bill Belichick cared enough about his players. Nick Fitzy Stevens' response.
I hate to say it, but no, he did. But at the same time, I can see exactly what Gary's pointing out to. It feels like Belichick cared for certain players, but I think he probably could have showed more compassion over time. And that sort of like callous indifference is what has frosted a lot of people to his reputation and achievements, Andy. So I can see how that would come across the wrong way to players like Ted, to certain fans, and obviously the media like Gary Myers.
And obviously to some of the players that felt like they were X's and O's on a board or just these interchangeable whatevers. I mean, Ted, you can speak to that. You were that at one point. You were Ted Johnson, the person, but also just Ted Johnson, the X and O that was a part of a game plan one week, maybe not the next week. Did you feel that Bill didn't care enough about his players?
I didn't, comparatively speaking to all the other coaches, without question. Like any coach I've ever had at any level, college, you know, and I played at a program in college that was felt like a pro program at Colorado. Coach Mack was very, very a tough coach, but there was more compassion in the way he taught and the way he coached. There was more compassion with with Parcells, more compassion and a more connection, emotional investment in his players. Pete Carroll was that way. So Bill was definitely different than all those other guys. So I would say, yeah, it's, He did not really, and you know, I think Gary makes a point to some degree. He just didn't. I think part of it is that he doesn't like to connect with people in general, not just his players, so that he has to cut them someday. I think that's just an easy way to kind of excuse the behavior. It's just, well, he's got to have to cut them someday. That didn't seem to bother Pete, and that didn't seem to bother Parcells, mm-hmm. that they could get close to guys knowing that they had to cut them someday.
So can I propose a theory here? It's got nothing to do with players. Nothing to do with players. I just think that's how Bill is. I think Bill is very cold. I don't think
I think he is with his family. I think
he's friends. Everybody. Yeah, everybody. I mean, if you look at it, a lot of his relationships are what people would call star bleeper relationships. They're like celebrity level relationships. I know Ernie Adams is a different level. Ernie Adams has been with him back to whatever, Phillips Andover or whatever academy. Mm-hmm. But a lot of his relationships are star bleeping relationships.
Yeah. It's what it, how can I, if having a relationship with this guy, how does it make me look kind of thing?
Right.
And that's the, and I will say this too. What Bill was different than other coaches, Belichick, excuse me, is I think he abused his power. I think he was in a position of power, and he was your CEO. He was in any corporation that abused power. I think Bill took advantage and abused his power with players, crossed the line a lot of times. So that's the part. It's like, you know, you don't have to be their best friends, but don't treat them unfairly. And there was a million examples that I saw and that I was part of, where there was a line that was crossed abusing your position of power.
So the one thing I will say is whether you liked it or not, whether I liked it or not, the results spoke for themselves, correct? I mean, Bill Belichick won a lot of football games. He ran the greatest, as Gary writes in the little blurb for his book, like the greatest dynasty in the history of all sports.
It was because he had Tom.
Yeah. And it was, absolutely.
It was because he had Tom.
But he ran it how he ran it, and it worked for him, right? It like the end result was 9 Super Bowl trips, 6 Super Bowl wins, all those division titles, all of these things. And go ahead.
Can I ask you a question? When Gary says that he doesn't think the how they perform away from each other should factor in, do you believe that?
No, I don't.
I thought
it was kind of ridiculous.
It's Gary. How can I love you, buddy, but I don't know how you can't factor in their records away from each other to decide who was more important in the dynasty. I don't know how you can do that.
And it's really weird, Fitzy, as we wrap this up here. I think Bill Belichick, if he heard the line about he didn't care enough about his players, Bill would be pissed. He would get really defensive about that. But if Bill heard the line about, well, what they did without each other is really irrelevant, I think Bill would be like, you tell him, Gary. That's a good point, Gary. You should say that louder. Maybe put it on a couple billboards for me. That was so. It was very, and that probably shows Gary's objectivity. He can kind of paint because he does have 4 decades of experience in New York and covering the Giants and the Jets and the Patriots and all those teams. So that was interesting. That's going to do it for the 4 o'clock hour. Fitzy, I think you're going to bow out of here. Have a good rest of your day. We will talk to you tomorrow at Fenway
See
Park.
See you tomorrow, gentlemen.
Ted Johnson, Andy Hart here. WEEI Afternoons rolling into the 5 o'clock hour where it's time for the drive. And we're going to talk a little Red Sox baseball because the good news is it can still be clinch day. Just looks like clinch day is going to have to involve a Bayo win in Toronto because those damn A's, they are not helping us out. That's up next in the drive.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, 2-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.